English Listening Comprehension Test, C2 Level, Valencian Community, 2020. Now you will hear the instructions for the listening test. You will have time to read all the questions for all the tasks in the exam. At the beginning of each listening, you will hear this sound. You can make notes or write your answers while you're listening, but remember that you will also have time to write your answers at the end of each exercise. Please, read the instructions for each exercise carefully. If you have any questions, ask them now, as you will not be able to talk during the listening test. Please, look at task 1. Listen to a podcast about volunteerism. For questions 1 to 7, choose the correct answer A, B or C. Write your answers on the answer sheet. Question 0 is an example. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1.5 minutes to read the questions.
Baby rescue is the ultimate volunteer experience. At Hope of Life International, a Christian mission in rural Guatemala, a rescue team springs into action when news arrives that a baby is dangerously ill in a nearby mountain village. The mission, which hosts hundreds of volunteers from North America every month, sends a caravan of jeeps, canoes, and an ambulance to bring the child to its hospital. Hope of Life has scouts who work in these mountain villages, looking for sick infants. Although time is of the essence, when they find an ailing baby, the scouts do not bring them directly to the hospital. Instead, they alert the organization, which assembles a team, accompanied by volunteers, to collect them. Many volunteers who come to Hope of Life are drawn by the dream of taking part in one of these expeditions. They get to save lives and have a transformational encounter. Every year, millions of people from wealthy nations travel to poor countries, hoping to do good. University students want to spend a school break or part of a summer giving back, perhaps even to improve their CV. Christians go with their churches for 1 or 2 week missions. All seek personal growth, connection to those less fortunate, and the satisfaction of making a difference. The aspiration to help the most vulnerable children is a noble one, but the booming business of voluntourism sustains practices and institutions that actually do harm. There is no such thing as a good orphanage, according to child development experts. 80 years of research confirms that children do best in a family. They are far more likely to experience abuse, cruelty, or neglect in an institution than in any other setting. Even in a well-run facility, children do not develop normally. In wealthy countries, the institutionalization of children has almost completely stopped. Instead, governments offer services that can help families keep children with them. If that is not possible, they seek adoptive parents or foster families. These solutions are imperfect. Some foster families are abusive. Children, especially those most in need of a steady home, can get shuffled from one family to another. But nobody is advocating going back to institutions. Almost every poor country, by contrast, still puts children in institutions, even though the vast majority of those children have families. Wealthy countries, who consider orphanages harmful for their own children, nonetheless provide a stream of charitable giving that makes orphanages viable businesses abroad. And orphanages need orphans. Parents may hand over children because they have special needs or because the family can't afford to send them to school. Donors from wealthy countries, most often religious groups, often establish orphanages in response to a crisis. But after the crisis is over, donations keep arriving, so the institution stays open. In Aceh, Indonesia, after the 2004 tsunami, hundreds of institutions for children were opened. But more than 97% of the children in them were brought by their families so they could get an education. Very few of the children had been affected by the tsunami at all. According to a report by Lumos, a London-based group founded by J.K. Rowling that seeks to end institutionalization of children, one orphanage in Haiti, established by a U.S. religious organization after the earthquake in 2010, kept children malnourished and living in filth, with no stimulation. Yet it collected donations averaging $10,000, £7,700, a year per child, much of which ended up in the director's bank account, a former staff member alleged. That institution, which Lumos believes was engaged in trafficking and selling children for adoption to families in wealthy countries, recruited children using a baby finder, who convinced poor parents their children would be better off in the institution. Voluntourism is an outgrowth of the ecotourism movement of the 1990s. According to Pippa Biddle, author of a forthcoming book on voluntourism, travelers rebelled against package trips and resorts and wanted a more authentic experience. And they were willing to pay for it. Many charities in developing countries run such programs and collect fees from volunteers.
Now listen again.
Baby rescue is the ultimate volunteer experience. At Hope of Life International, a Christian mission in rural Guatemala, a rescue team springs into action when news arrives that a baby is dangerously ill in a nearby mountain village. The mission, which hosts hundreds of volunteers from North America every month, sends a caravan of jeeps, canoes, and an ambulance to bring the child to its hospital. Hope of Life has scouts who work in these mountain villages, looking for sick infants. Although time is of the essence, when they find an ailing baby, the scouts do not bring them directly to the hospital. Instead, they alert the organization, which assembles a team, accompanied by volunteers, to collect them. Many volunteers who come to Hope of Life are drawn by the dream of taking part in one of these expeditions. They get to save lives and have a transformational encounter. Every year, millions of people from wealthy nations travel to poor countries, hoping to do good. University students want to spend a school break or part of a summer giving back, perhaps even to improve their CV. Christians go with their churches for 1 or 2 week missions. All seek personal growth, connection to those less fortunate, and the satisfaction of making a difference. The aspiration to help the most vulnerable children is a noble one, but the booming business of voluntourism sustains practices and institutions that actually do harm. There is no such thing as a good orphanage, according to child development experts. 80 years of research confirms that children do best in a family. They are far more likely to experience abuse, cruelty, or neglect in an institution than in any other setting. Even in a well-run facility, children do not develop normally. In wealthy countries, the institutionalization of children has almost completely stopped. Instead, governments offer services that can help families keep children with them. If that is not possible, they seek adoptive parents or foster families. These solutions are imperfect. Some foster families are abusive. Children, especially those most in need of a steady home, can get shuffled from one family to another. But nobody is advocating going back to institutions. Almost every poor country, by contrast, still puts children in institutions, even though the vast majority of those children have families. Wealthy countries, who consider orphanages harmful for their own children, nonetheless provide a stream of charitable giving that makes orphanages viable businesses abroad. And orphanages need orphans. Parents may hand over children because they have special needs or because the family can't afford to send them to school. Donors from wealthy countries, most often religious groups, often establish orphanages in response to a crisis. But after the crisis is over, donations keep arriving, so the institution stays open. In Aceh, Indonesia, after the 2004 tsunami, hundreds of institutions for children were opened. But more than 97% of the children in them were brought by their families so they could get an education. Very few of the children had been affected by the tsunami at all. According to a report by Lumos, a London-based group founded by J.K. Rowling that seeks to end institutionalization of children, one orphanage in Haiti, established by a U.S. religious organization after the earthquake in 2010, kept children malnourished and living in filth, with no stimulation. Yet it collected donations averaging $10,000, £7,700, a year per child, much of which ended up in the director's bank account, a former staff member alleged. That institution, which Lumos believes was engaged in trafficking and selling children for adoption to families in wealthy countries, recruited children using a baby finder, who convinced poor parents their children would be better off in the institution. Voluntourism is an outgrowth of the ecotourism movement of the 1990s. According to Pippa Biddle, author of a forthcoming book on voluntourism, travelers rebelled against package trips and resorts and wanted a more authentic experience. And they were willing to pay for it. Many charities in developing countries run such programs and collect fees from volunteers.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. Please, look at the second exercise. Listen to some extracts in which seven people talk about mental health and match the statements B to J to what they say. Extract 0 is an example. There are two statements that do not correspond to any extracts. Write your answers on the answer sheet. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the statements. Example.
There's also psychological harms that are well documented that social media brings that we do need to address. So we know from the research literature that the more you use social media, the more likely you are to feel lonely or isolated. We know that the constant exposure to your friends' carefully curated positive portrayals of their life can leave you to feel inadequate and can increase rates of depression. And there's a fundamental mismatch between the way our brains are wired and this behavior of exposing yourself to stimuli with intermittent rewards throughout all of your waking hours.
Speaker 1.
Imagine that you're getting ready to go to a party. You feel excited, but also nervous. And you've got this feeling in your stomach, almost like another heartbeat. There's something holding you back from getting too happy. No, you mustn't get too happy. Better to be cautious. Otherwise, something bad might happen. You start wondering, who should I talk to when I get there? What if no one wants to talk to me? When you arrive at the party, someone starts talking with you, and your mind starts racing. Your heart begins pounding. It feels like it's an out-of-body experience and you're just watching yourself talk. Keep it together, you say to yourself, but you can't and it's just getting worse. After the person you've been speaking to leaves, you feel utterly defeated.
Speaker 2.
First of all, there are changes that could be seen with the naked eye and X-ray vision. These include smaller frontal lobes and hippocampal volumes. On a more micro scale, depression is associated with a few things: the abnormal transmission or depletion of certain neurotransmitters, blunted circadian rhythms, or specific changes in the REM and slow wave parts of your sleep cycle, and hormone abnormalities. But neuroscientists still don't have a complete picture of what causes depression. It seems to have to do with a complex interaction between genes and environment. But we don't have a diagnostic tool that can accurately predict where or when it will show up.
Speaker 3.
Normal anxiety is an emotion that we all get when we're in stressful situations. For example, let's say you're out in the woods and you come face to face with a bear. This will probably make you feel a little bit anxious, and you'll probably want to start running like crazy. Now, this anxious feeling that you get is good because it protects you, it saves you, and it makes you want to hightail it out of there. Anxiety helps us meet our deadlines at work and deal with emergencies in life. But when this anxiety emotion is taken to the extreme and arises in situations which don't pose a real threat, then that's when you might have an anxiety disorder.
Speaker 4.
Now, my way of dealing with adversity is to face it head on. So I spent the next 2 years researching depression and anxiety, and what I found was mind-blowing. The World Health Organization reports that depression is the leading cause of sickness and disability in the world. While the exact cause of depression isn't clear, research suggests that most mental disorders develop, at least in part, because of a chemical imbalance in the brain and/or an underlying genetic predisposition. So you can't just shake it off.
Speaker 5.
There's a common misconception that if you like to meticulously organize your things, keep your hands clean, or plan out your weekend to the last detail, you might have OCD. In fact, OCD, which stands for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, is a serious psychiatric condition that is frequently misunderstood by society and mental health professionals alike. Repetitive or ritualistic behaviors are synonymous with OCD. Obsessive compulsive disorder has two aspects, obsessions and the behavioral compulsions people engage in to relieve the anxiety the obsessions cause. The kinds of actions that people often associate with OCD, like excessive hand washing or checking things repeatedly, may be examples of obsessive or compulsive tendencies, but the actual disorder is far more rare.
Speaker 6.
The adverse childhood experiences study is something that everybody needs to know about. They asked 17,500 adults about their history of exposure to what they called adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. Those include physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, physical or emotional neglect, parental mental illness, substance dependence, incarceration, parental separation or divorce, or domestic violence. For every yes, you would get a point on your ACE score. And then what they did was they correlated these ACE scores against health outcomes. What they found was striking. Two things. Number one, ACEs are incredibly common. The second thing that they found was that there was a dose-response relationship between ACEs and health outcomes. The higher your ACE score, the worse your health outcomes.
Speaker 7.
A way to overcome indecision and this lack of control in life is to do it badly. There's a quote by writer and poet G.K. Chesterton that says, "Anything worth doing is worth doing badly the first time." The reason why this works so well is that it speeds up your decision-making and catapults you straight into action. Otherwise, you can spend hours deciding how you should go about doing something or what you should do. This can be paralyzing and can make you afraid to even begin. All too often, we aim for perfection, but never end up doing anything because the standards that we set for ourselves are too high. So we delay starting something, or we might even abandon the whole thing altogether.
Now listen again. Speaker 1.
Imagine that you're getting ready to go to a party. You feel excited, but also nervous. And you've got this feeling in your stomach, almost like another heartbeat. There's something holding you back from getting too happy. No, you mustn't get too happy. Better to be cautious. Otherwise, something bad might happen. You start wondering, who should I talk to when I get there? What if no one wants to talk to me? When you arrive at the party, someone starts talking with you, and your mind starts racing. Your heart begins pounding. It feels like it's an out-of-body experience, and you're just watching yourself talk. Keep it together, you say to yourself, but you can't, and it's just getting worse. After the person you've been speaking to leaves, you feel utterly defeated.
Speaker 2.
First of all, there are changes that could be seen with the naked eye and X-ray vision. These include smaller frontal lobes and hippocampal volumes. On a more micro scale, depression is associated with a few things: the abnormal transmission or depletion of certain neurotransmitters, blunted circadian rhythms, or specific changes in the REM and slow wave parts of your sleep cycle, and hormone abnormalities. But neuroscientists still don't have a complete picture of what causes depression. It seems to have to do with a complex interaction between genes and environment, but we don't have a diagnostic tool that can accurately predict where or when it will show up.
Speaker 3.
Normal anxiety is an emotion that we all get when we're in stressful situations. For example, let's say you're out in the woods and you come face to face with a bear. This will probably make you feel a little bit anxious, and you'll probably want to start running like crazy. Now, this anxious feeling that you get is good because it protects you, it saves you, and it makes you want to hightail it out of there. Anxiety helps us meet our deadlines at work and deal with emergencies in life. But when this anxiety emotion is taken to the extreme and arises in situations which don't pose a real threat, then that's when you might have an anxiety disorder.
Speaker 4.
Now, my way of dealing with adversity is to face it head on. So I spent the next 2 years researching depression and anxiety, and what I found was mind-blowing. The World Health Organization reports that depression is the leading cause of sickness and disability in the world. While the exact cause of depression isn't clear, research suggests that most mental disorders develop at least in part because of a chemical imbalance in the brain and/or an underlying genetic predisposition. So you can't just shake it off.
Speaker 5.
There's a common misconception that if you like to meticulously organize your things, keep your hands clean, or plan out your weekend to the last detail, you might have OCD. In fact, OCD, which stands for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, is a serious psychiatric condition that is frequently misunderstood by society and mental health professionals alike. Repetitive or ritualistic behaviors are synonymous with OCD. Obsessive Compulsive Disorder has two aspects: obsessions and the behavioral compulsions people engage in to relieve the anxiety the obsessions cause. The kinds of actions that people often associate with OCD, like excessive hand washing or checking things repeatedly, may be examples of obsessive or compulsive tendencies, but the actual disorder is far more rare.
Speaker 6.
The Adverse Childhood Experiences Study is something that everybody needs to know about. They asked 17,500 adults about their history of exposure to what they called adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. Those include physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, physical or emotional neglect, parental mental illness, substance dependence, incarceration, parental separation or divorce, or domestic violence. For every yes, you would get a point on your ACE score. And then what they did was they correlated these ACE scores against health outcomes. What they found was striking. Two things. Number one, ACEs are incredibly common. The second thing that they found was that there was a dose-response relationship between ACEs and health outcomes. The higher your ACE score, the worse your health outcomes.
Speaker 7.
A way to overcome indecision and this lack of control in life is to do it badly. There's a quote by writer and poet G.K. Chesterton that says, "Anything worth doing is worth doing badly the first time." The reason why this works so well is that it speeds up your decision-making and catapults you straight into action. Otherwise, you can spend hours deciding how you should go about doing something or what you should do. This can be paralyzing and can make you afraid to even begin. All too often, we aim for perfection, but never end up doing anything because the standards that we set for ourselves are too high. So we delay starting something, or we might even abandon the whole thing altogether.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. Please, look at the third exercise. Listen to a podcast about the Brexit. Fill in the gaps 1 to 12 with the exact word or words you hear, a maximum of 3 words per gap. Write your answers in capital letters and do not forget to copy your answers on the answer sheet. 0 is an example. You now have 2 minutes to read the sentences.
My name is Tim Harford. I am a columnist at the Financial Times. And
an economist.
Oh, yeah, that.
Well, let's start with, I mean, it seemed like this might be, there have been lots and lots and lots of delays, and it seemed like this vote, I mean, Boris Johnson's whole thing, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's whole thing was no more delays. We're going to do this thing, rip the Band-Aid off, Brexit's going to happen. I think he said over his dead body, would there be another delay?
He said over his dead body, he said he would rather die in a ditch than send a letter to the European Commission asking for a delay. He has sent a letter to the European Commission asking for a delay. So, I mean, that's not the first time the Prime Minister said something that turned out not to be true. I mean, there are just a lot of different people who want different things. There are hardline Brexiters who would just be delighted to have the most catastrophic and disruptive exit possible, although they don't seem to think it would be catastrophic and disruptive, but it clearly, obviously would. There are people who would like a very soft Brexit because that would respect the will of the people, but would not be too economically damaging. There are people
so that
who
would keep some of the trade relationships in place with yeah. European countries and allow maybe some of the businesses that are kind of operating across countries to continue?
Absolutely. I mean, there are two moving parts to that. There's a customs union and there's the single market. They sound like the same thing, but the customs union is more about frictionless trade in goods, and the single market is more about common standards for services like banking, media, insurance, and the free movement of people. And so there are proposals to stay in the European Customs Union, and there are proposals to stay in the European Single Market, and there are proposals to stay in both, and there are proposals to leave both. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, but there are communities in Northern Ireland who would rather that it was part of the Irish Republic. And up until recently, I mean, people got killed quite a lot, and not just the border, but I mean, there were bombs in London. But more recently, there's been a peace, and the peace has been based on the fact that, well, look, the UK is in the European Union and the Republic of Ireland is in the European Union. And so these negotiations between the UK and the European Union have been heavily influenced by the question of what's going to happen on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But that's where we are.
What are the economic, like, I would love to look at the pros and cons of the extensions. Like, what are the pros of continuing to kind of extend the, or to continue to delay?
Well, it very much depends on your point of view. I think clearly the advantage of delaying is that if you don't like what's been agreed, you might be able to get something that you prefer. So a lot of this is strategic, but purely from the point of view of ordinary citizens and businesses, you do at some stage want to know what is likely to happen. And the trouble with the Brexit vote, we originally voted in June 2016. And of course, there was uncertainty about what the vote would be. Then once we had the vote, there was uncertainty about what would happen next. So that's the theory of it. But there's lots of good empirical evidence as well that uncertainty does slow down economic activity. It does depress investment. And if you look, for example, at investment in the British economy relative to investment in the American economy, in the German economy, it's not a pretty picture. So I know yeah. we're not the only country in the world that's polarized, but people take it very personally. People find it really hard to see any good in the opposing point of view. The leavers, you know, think of the remainers as betraying the country. The remainers think the leavers are just a bunch of idiots and racists. It's got really personal, and that is it's very worrying, because in the end I don't think this deal is great for the country. But what is more damaging than any particular deal is the bitterness and the distrust that the whole argument has brought.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you so much for talking Brexit. I appreciate it.
Now listen again.
My name is Tim Harford. I am a columnist at the Financial Times and...
And an economist.
Oh, yeah, that.
Well, let's start with, I mean, it seemed like this might be, there have been lots and lots and lots of delays, and it seemed like this vote, I mean, Boris Johnson's whole thing, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's whole thing was no more delays. We're going to do this thing, rip the Band-Aid off, Brexit's going to happen. I think he said over his dead body, would there be another delay?
He said over his dead body, he said he would rather die in a ditch than send a letter to the European Commission asking for a delay. He has sent a letter to the European Commission asking for a delay. So, I mean, that's not the first time the Prime Minister said something that turned out not to be true. I mean, there are just a lot of different people who want different things. There are hardline Brexiters who would just be delighted to have the most catastrophic and disruptive exit possible, although they don't seem to think it would be catastrophic and disruptive, but it clearly, obviously would. There are people who would like a very soft Brexit because that would respect the will of the people, but would not be too economically damaging. There are people
so that
who...
would keep some of the trade relationships in place with yeah. European countries and allow maybe some of the businesses that are kind of operating across countries to continue?
Absolutely. I mean, there are two moving parts to that. There's a customs union and there's the single market. They sound like the same thing, but the customs union is more about frictionless trade in goods, and the single market is more about common standards for services like banking, media, insurance, and the free movement of people. And so there are proposals to stay in the European Customs Union, and there are proposals to stay in the European Single Market, and there are proposals to stay in both, and there are proposals to leave both. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, but there are communities in Northern Ireland who would rather that it was part of the Irish Republic. And up until recently, I mean, people got killed quite a lot, and not just the border, but I mean, there were bombs in London. But more recently, there's been a peace, and the peace has been based on the fact that, well, look, the UK's in the European Union and the Republic of Ireland is in the European Union. And so these negotiations between the UK and the European Union have been heavily influenced by the question of what's going to happen on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But that's where we are.
What are the economic... Like, I would love to look at the pros and cons of the extensions. Like, what are the pros of continuing to kind of extend the, or to continue to delay?
Well, it very much depends on your point of view. I think clearly the advantage of delaying is that if you don't like what's been agreed, you might be able to get something that you prefer. So a lot of this is strategic, but purely from the point of view of ordinary citizens and businesses, you do at some stage want to know what is likely to happen. And the trouble with the Brexit vote, we originally voted in June 2016. And of course, there was uncertainty about what the vote would be. Then once we had the vote, there was uncertainty about what would happen next. So that's the theory of it. But there's lots of good empirical evidence as well that uncertainty does slow down economic activity. It does depress investment. And if you look, for example, at investment in the British economy relative to investment in the American economy, in the German economy, it's not a pretty picture. So I know we're not the only country in the world that's polarized, but people take it very personally. People find it really hard to see any good in the opposing point of view. The leavers, you know, think of the Remainers as betraying the country. The Remainers think the leavers are just a bunch of idiots and racists. It's got really personal, and that is it's very worrying, because in the end, I don't think this deal is great for the country. But what is more damaging than any particular deal is the bitterness and the distrust that the whole argument has brought.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you so much for talking Brexit. I appreciate it.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the English Listening Comprehension Test C2 level, Valencian Community 2020.